Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees. So I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in two orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply.
How are you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing good, Justin. How are you feeling?
I'm doing great. Before we get into the show, have you watched any good TV shows lately?
On Netflix, I saw that there was a new show by the Coen brothers.
Oh, what's that?
You know, the Coen brothers, they made The Big Lebowski, which we're both big fans of. It's The Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
What is it about?
It's a movie-length show, but it's in six parts, I think. Mm-hmm. And I've only seen five of them.
Oh, okay.
They're all sort of Western stories. They all take place in the 1800s. And the first story is just plain bizarre. It's about a gunslinger. And I can tell you that almost every story is a downer.
Good. I'm looking forward to this.
It's sort of like there's some dark humor. And then it's followed by darkness.
Nice.
If you want something weird and well done, this is it. There's nothing else like it on Netflix.
The only new show that I've seen lately is Tell Me a Story. And it's Three Little Pigs, Little Red Riding Hood, and Hansel and Gretel. But it's retold in a modern-ish way, all twisted and distorted into this new story. And really, it has very little to do with the Three Little Pigs, Little Red Riding Hood, and Hansel and Gretel. It's just, that's what their idea was. But it's a good show. I'm digging it. I'm only a few episodes in. I think four. So it's well done. And I just heard news that I think it's Jordan Peele is bringing the Twilight Zone back. That will be interesting.
They attempted to bring it back before. You know, it was okay, but
they failed every time, actually.
I really like the old-time radio versions of Twilight Zone, but Jordan Peele, maybe he can pull it off.
Yeah, I got faith.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tonight's case, we're looking at Beverly Hills, California. It's a very nice area if you haven't been. August 20th, 1989. This is before we've heard a term called affluenza, before O.J. Simpson. This has probably been up in our top 10 most requested cases, I think. Maybe top 5, I don't know. I don't think there's a lot of mystery to this case, although some people think that this is a big enough story that it requires multiple parts, and I don't think Aaron and I do. I think it's pretty straightforward. So, what are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Well, despite there not being a lot of mystery here, there is a lot to discuss. And of course, the case is the Menendez brothers case, which involved the 1989 slayings of Jose and Kitty Menendez, which were the parents of Lyle and Eric Menendez. Eric was 18 years old at the time, and Lyle was 21. The Menendez estate was valued at more than $14 million.
On this night, Lyle and Eric, armed with shotguns, enter their parents' home. They point their weapons at their parents, who are sitting on the couch watching a James Bond movie, and they begin to shoot their parents with these pump-action shotguns.
Yeah, 12-gauge shotguns. It is said that Jose didn't even know this happened. He died immediately.
Now, their mother, Kitty, she actually jumped up and tried to run away after the initial volley of blasts coming at them. She was injured, but she tried to escape. And we know this because there was blood in the tread of her sneakers. So Lyle and Eric had to reload. I think they had to go back out to their car and grab more ammo and reload.
They didn't have extra shotgun shells on them, so they had to go back out to the car and get more.
To finish off their mother.
Right, and I believe Eric handed the ammunition to his brother Lyle, who loaded the shotgun and then proceeded to go inside and finished off his own mother.
So this isn't really a heat of the moment type deal. This isn't a break. This is, they had shotguns and they went in and they slaughtered their parents. So after they shoot their parents, they end up calling 911. And you can find this phone call. It's readily available pretty much anywhere in any documentary about this this case. And they tell the dispatchers that they have come home to find their parents have been murdered.
Yeah, they had said they had gone out to the movies. And then, as you said, had come home and found their parents murdered.
So what movie did they say they went out and saw?
Well, they had planned to go see Batman, but it was sold out. I mean, I don't know if you remember at the time, but that movie was huge when it came out. It was Tim Burton's Batman. This was 1989.
So they went to another movie, which was a James Bond film titled License to Kill.
We know they're lying to dispatchers. They're screaming and yelling and playing off that they found their parents. And it's just ironic that they would say that, oh, we went to a Bond movie, when that just happens to be the same movie that, not the same movie, but another James Bond movie that their parents are watching. Just a little connection there. I know you're a big Bond movie fan, so.
We know that they planned to kill their parents, but at the time when police showed up, they didn't admit to killing their parents.
No, they stick to their story that they find their parents when they came home. They were at this James Bond movie, and they were at this movie, and they even go so far as to insinuate that it might be a mob hit because of some of the wounds to their parents, which includes shooting them in the kneecap. And I guess that's a technique that it's claimed mobsters will use. You cap them. The police truly believe that what they're seeing is a cold-blooded murder, and they believe these two very affluent, rich, everyone calls them the boys and kids, but they're adults. What the police won't do is do a preemptive gunshot residue test on either one of their hands. They won't search their cars, which that's where they put the shotguns after they murdered their parents, was in the trunk of their cars.
Yeah, they actually ended up ditching those shotguns near Mulholland Drive. And they did that before they went to buy tickets at the movie theater.
This is to try to establish their alibi of why they weren't home at the time of the murder. So this is around 10 o'clock at night.
All we can say is the investigators did talk to them for hours, but you know, there's so much they missed. And I think it's because sometimes, and I'm sure anybody can make mistakes, but there was a lot of assuming going on. They assumed that these sons were very distraught by the murders of their parents and that they weren't likely to be involved. And I don't know if them being part of a wealthy family had something to do with that. I kind of want to say yes.
I think that's a huge factor. This is Beverly Hills. They're living in a mansion with tennis courts out back. You change this situation. You put this murder anywhere else. I think the police are going to be questioning the guys, whoever finds the victims, and probably testing their hands, but who knows?
The investigators spoke with neighbors, and they had reported hearing something around 10 p.m., bangs, but they thought it was just kids playing with fireworks or something. But that's about the time that this couple was murdered.
Yeah, they probably don't know what gunfire sounds like.
Jose had been shot 5 or 6 times with shotguns, and his wife, Kitty, had been shot about 10 times.
Jose's unrecognizable. They pretty much blew his head off. Kitty, similar situation. It's gruesome.
Yeah, Kitty was shot in the face. And so you look at this crime and you think, this is a crime of hatred or of payback. So when Lyle called the police, he called about 11:30 p.m. And as we already said, he sounded really upset. In fact, they had trouble understanding him because he was so upset on the phone. And we've talked before about 911 calls and how people sound and this and that. But this is a distraught person on the phone. I mean, if someone just played that call and didn't give me any other information.
It sounds serious. It sounds legit. And it's hard to determine anything off a 911 call. Anyone that says, oh, I can tell they're lying, it's like, okay, whatever. In this case, we know the truth going in. So it's easy to dismantle his call, but he's a good actor. And guess what? Shooting your parents or killing somebody is a very high-stress situation, and you can use that to influence your heightened, state and cry and scream and yell. And it
sounds and looks legit because you are distraught because you've just done something that's terrible.
There were a couple of detectives assigned to this case. Unfortunately for them, this whole mob hit angle didn't really work. They couldn't find any way to establish that there was a connection here other than it does look like it could have been a mob hit.
Well, they're trying to figure out who doesn't like this family, who would come in and do this. Maybe it's just because we've been covering cases like this. I'm thinking, look at the people that know the family and look at the people that are closest to the family, or look at the family members who found the bodies. Luckily, it doesn't take long for them to kind of figure out that this isn't a mob hit, but still, initially, they go in buying the brother's story, hook, line, and sinker.
And really all that they had was the killings were really, really violent. There was the kneecapping of the victims. And then also, they couldn't find any shotgun casings there in the house. So it's like someone cleaned it up. But of course, you don't have to be a professional hitman to pick up your shells when you're done, right? You just need a little bit of time.
Yeah. And if you weren't wearing gloves when you loaded the shotgun, well, you might leave some fingerprints on those shells.
If we could point to one thing in this case that says, here's when they start to look at the sons of the Menendezes, what would you say it was? Because when I looked into this, to me, it was the spending spree that the two went on.
I concur. I can't say that. I understand that if you're from a very rich background, then going out and dropping $200 on a steak dinner probably doesn't mean that much to you. If your parents or you've suffered some sort of terrible tragedy, you might still go out and drop $200 on that steak dinner that week. But the level of what these two guys did, I don't think anyone can justify it. So where do we start? What is their behavior like after their parents have been slaughtered by potentially this dangerous mob that could come back and end their lives, right?
Well, one of the things that happens within 11 days is a computer expert is hired to delete some files on the family computer. And if you think about it, they're looking to inherit quite a bit of money from the parents. But this is where we get into, there's a massive amount of information about these two sons and what they had been up to and about the problems within the family and then the subsequent spending spree that they went on after their parents' murders. So I think what we should do is actually start with the spending spree, because the spending spree is, as we were talking about, probably what got investigators looking at them seriously, because usually, you know, I say usually because not everyone reacts the same way to something like this, but in this case, with their parents being brutally murdered, and then they had come home and found them murdered, they're spending tons of money. And what's tons of money? Well over $700,000 of money. So let's kind of go over what they were buying.
Real quick, that's not how much they normally spend in a normal month or two. Their spending habits, their behavior has changed drastically. They wouldn't drop $700,000, or they didn't drop $700,000 6 months before this. So put that in perspective. Where did they start?
Well, just 4 days after the killings, they spent $15,000 or so on three Rolex watches, which both of them were wearing a new Rolex watch each the day of the funeral. The funeral was 5 days after the murders.
So they had brand new expensive suits and Rolex watches to go with the suits for this funeral. I mean, they had to buy these watches for the funeral to look good. You got to keep up appearances, right?
They were spending tens of thousands of dollars on clothing. Lyle went out and bought a $64,000 Porsche Carrera. It was a special edition. And Eric bought a new Jeep Wrangler.
Now, inflation and everything considered, 1989, a $64,000 Porsche would cost about $120,000 today. It's like double.
Any number we throw out there from this time, just double it, and that's how much it would be today.
Lyle put down $300,000 on a restaurant. It was a cafe in Princeton, New Jersey, but he renamed the restaurant Mr. Buffalo's. And meanwhile, Eric was trying to become a rock promoter, and he sunk about $40,000 into a rock concert at the LA Palladium. Although that didn't end up working out, the guy took his money. But he also hired a tennis expert to train him, which was a cost of $60,000 a year, they say. But that was his goal, is to become a professional tennis player. Now, all told, they were getting properties. I guess you could say, like, there was a rental of a bungalow suite at the Hotel Bel Air. They had a private limousine. They had a ski trip to Aspen, big screen TV. They vacationed different places in Lake Tahoe and Cancun, Mexico. And they made some investments. So spending quite a bit of money. But what was their insurance payout, Justin? Because their parents died. They had some sort of insurance that paid out pretty soon thereafter.
Oh, about 5 weeks after the murders, they got a pre-payout of like $400,000. And then they got an additional $250,000 after that. So all told, it was around $650,000.
Plus, they had their parents' estate.
But before they even got this insurance payout, I mean, they had already blown through hundreds of thousands of dollars. What was the movie? Was it Brewster's Millions or something? Where
he had to spend $30 million, but he had all these rules about it. And yeah, then if he managed to spend the $30 million, he would get $300 million.
Yeah.
It was Richard Pryor, wasn't it?
I'm 99% sure. Yeah. I haven't seen the movie.
And John Candy, I think.
It was a great movie when I was a kid.
It was a great movie, yeah.
This is how I feel. Like, their parents are murdered and they're just running through this money. Is it retail therapy? I don't know. The mob hit angle isn't working out for investigators, and the brothers are behaving this way. The focus turns on them pretty quickly. It's not long before investigators are charging them. They're going to be indicted. Now, at trial, a lot of crazy things happen. We need to give a lot of context to these things that are brought up in trial. We need to give some background on who these people are. So where do we start there, Aaron?
It'll help us to understand how exactly these events came about, I suppose. Jose Menendez was born in Havana, Cuba. Very athletic guy, very good at soccer. His family actually was known for their athleticism. They kind of had their own fame. But when Fidel Castro overthrew the government in 1959, it changed everything for them. Just so you understand why it would, Fidel Castro just took people's property and their wealth. So they couldn't very well stay there. And they moved to the United States. Jose would end up meeting, while in the United States in 1962, he met a woman who went by the name Kitty. Her name was actually Mary Louise Anderson. This was sort of a forbidden love situation because their parents didn't want them together. Jose's parents didn't like Mary because her parents were divorced. And then her family didn't like Jose so much because he was Cuban. I don't know if that helped their relationship, but they stuck together. Both went on to become pretty successful, I would say. And Jose built up his wealth by climbing the ladder. And he passed a CPA exam. He started working for an accounting firm. And so from there, he kept going on and moving up the ladder. He became a comptroller and then eventually became a president of a company. Of course, once you hit that level, more opportunities open up. And sure enough, he did. He sort of went into the entertainment business, I guess you could say. He ended up working at Live Entertainment, became the CEO. This was in 1987. And he was making over $500,000 a year. His wife, at some point, even though she was successful, she became a stay-at-home mother. It seemed like the family had everything. They had money. They had organization. Their sons could attend good universities. It looked idyllic, right?
Well, they move out to California for his job. They first live in Calabasas, which I grew up in the Thousand Oaks area. So Calabasas was a really nice area. And then they move from there to Beverly Hills. So you can kind of get the level they are at there.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements, I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better. Notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
You say that they're able to go to good universities, but not so much. Their academic level is not the best, and they do struggle. They get into universities because they're rich and their parents are able to make donations and cut corners, back channel them to get them the things that he thinks they want, deserve, or should have. Growing up, Lyle and Eric weren't the best kids. I'm assuming that they might have been bored or acting out for other reasons, but there were situations where they had planned to break into homes and then ended up doing this after lots of scheming, right?
Right. It seemed apparent that Lyle and Eric weren't really into getting a good education. That's what their father wanted. Some of this might be due to their controlling, overbearing father. And that's the best way I can put it. From what we understand, he very much wanted his kids to be successful. And he had a vision of how he wanted his sons to be. And they weren't really living up to that. And they ended up burglarizing homes and taking what amounted to, what wasn't it, over $150,000 worth of stuff from people in the area?
Yeah, they would back up a van into the driveway and try to empty out the house as much as they could. Their father, it was said that he considered his sons his thoroughbreds, like he was raising show horses, you know, race horses of some type. But of course, they're not behaving the way he wants. They're talking back, they're acting out. Their father's having to deal with the aftermath of this, and he doesn't want the media knowing about this. He doesn't want this going on his son's permanent record. So he'll actually go and find all the victims that they've robbed, that they've stolen from, plead with them and say, hey, what did they take? How much was it? I'll pay you right now on the spot. And he wrote out, you know, pretty much blank checks to people that his sons had victimized.
Another thing that had been happening at the home was the parents weren't getting along. Kitty and Jose had a lot of troubles. Jose was having affairs. Kitty was drinking and taking pills. Even though from the outside it looked like this was a successful family that had it all, they weren't special where they didn't have issues. They had issues. So thinking about the way their dad wanted them to be, the problems between the parents, and then there was a lot of hostility going on within the home. We don't know if the burglaries were happening because they were looking to act out, because that's what kids do sometimes. They act out. And I understand they're adults, basically, but you wonder if some of this was because they were trying to act out and just cause more problems because they were sick and tired of being told how they were supposed to be.
Kitty was marginalized in the family. I think that everyone in the family was disrespecting her and didn't adhere. Like when she would say, go clean your room or go do this or that, they didn't listen. It was only when Jose, their father, would give them a command that they would be scared or respect him. If they did something wrong, the father would take away their credit cards, take away their allowance. So then they would steal money from their mother's purse. They would take credit cards from the drawers and then go run up bills and spend their parents' money, regardless if they had permission to do so. They were referred to as playboys. They would have limo rides to school, and this is like high school. They would date cheerleaders or even models. It was a very affluent time for them growing up as teens. Eric even wrote a screenplay. Talented guy. He's intelligent. His screenplay was about a child who kills his parents for money. And oddly enough, the first 4 or 5 pages of this screenplay play out essentially the same way his parents are killed. Now, I think of the Burns and Raffae episode with Burns being in the school play, which happens to be about a murder, and I give him a pass because he's in a school play. He didn't put on the play. He's just a character in it.
And it was based on a crime where the two perpetrators thought so highly of themselves that they thought, there's no way we're going to get caught. We're too smart. Yeah. This is not the same situation.
No.
Because they just happened to share those characteristics with the killers that the play was based on. But in this case, this is a story fabricated by Eric.
Yeah. He's writing it himself. And it's eerily similar to the way this goes down. Now, during their childhood, there are lots of relatives and friends that will confirm that their father was not a nice guy and that he did rule with an iron fist. They routinely saw belt marks or bruises on the brothers, especially if they'd been spanked or if they were wearing tennis shorts, they could see the welts on their legs. One of their cousins, Diane Vandermolten, says when Lyle spent the night, he wanted to sleep in her bed because he was afraid of his father and she would let him. So this kind of goes into possibly more than just physical abuse or mental abuse. He says that his father will come to his bed at night. So this cousin's insinuating that, not even really insinuating, is saying that Lyle had confessed or confided in her that he was being molested at a young age. And this is between the ages of 6 and 18. If they are being abused or even sexually molested, now some of their outbursts, some of their behavior might make more sense because they don't know what to do.
The trial started July 20th, 1993. This is some time later.
Well, they had lawyered up literally the day of reporting their parents' murder. So they were ready for this.
For the first trial, the two brothers were tried separately. We're not going to bore you with all the details. All you have to know is four of the first trials, the defense strategy became, hey, these guys were being sexually abused at home. I don't know that they believed, or at least I don't know that their defense attorney believed that this was going to get them off completely. But what it was going to do is give them a chance to win when they had all the evidence in the world against them. I mean, by that point, the investigators, the prosecutors, everybody knew that they had done it. That wasn't even a question.
Yeah, and they had actually confessed to friends and others that they had killed their parents. So multiple witnesses there to say, yeah, they told me they did it. And that's another pivotal moment when the authorities turn on the brothers.
Yeah, Eric and Lyle Menendez had talked about killing their parents with their psychiatrist, and Judalon Smith, who was having an affair with the psychiatrist, well, when she and he broke up, she decided to go to the police about what she had heard because he had played recordings of them confessing. And so she knew about the killings. So she went to the police, and it was all because she and he had broken up.
Their friend Craig, who they had confessed to, they had also confided in him about the abuse that was going on. And so initially, when the prosecutor and investigators had talked to him, he was very forthcoming with information and told them about the abuse and whatnot, and the murder of Kitty and Jose. But when he takes the stand, it's a little different.
Yeah, he seems to not recall talking about this. And that surprises the prosecutor, because the prosecutor said that they had spoken on multiple occasions and there were recordings made of this this discussion. So anyway, during trial, they play the recordings and he has to admit, yes, that's my voice on the recording, but I just don't remember talking about this stuff.
It's such a weird flip-flop on his part. And I can only imagine that he had lawyered up and or had talked to the Menendez brothers' defense attorney, and she said, you need to distance yourself from this because you could be an accessory or you could be charged with something, whatever. Even though he's kind of the prosecutor's witness, I think somebody got in his ear and told him to stop talking.
Well, but see, to me, and I don't know if I just don't understand the testimony well enough, but it seemed to me as if by saying, yes, they were talking about the abuse, it was helping the mitigating factors angle.
Yeah.
Because he was saying, I had heard about this before the murders ever happened.
Yeah.
Doesn't that seem like that would help the defense? I mean, what else do they have? Everyone knows that they murdered their parents. This is the reason why they were being abused. He's saying, hey, I knew about the abuse. They told me about it. And he had even said on the recordings that he had been abused. Not by their parents, yeah. But...
It's a weird flip-flop, because does he care about the brothers and he doesn't want to be prejudiced towards them? Or has he had a change of heart and he doesn't like them? But regardless, saying I don't remember is removing himself from the situation.
Yeah, maybe he... I mean, the only other thing I can think of, other than an attorney saying, look, you don't want to get involved in this, is maybe... he on his own decided he didn't want to be involved anymore. This was freaking him out, being in a court of law.
Yeah. I guess that's what we have to come down on, because I don't know who he was talking to or what his motivation would be. Also, they found that they'd purchased the shotguns from a store in San Diego just prior to the murder.
Using a friend's ID.
Yeah.
They had purchased the shotguns, and then the following day, they went with their parents on a shark fishing trip, if you want to call it that. And then it was the following day after that that they murdered their parents.
They also confessed to their psychologist, but days before the murder, Kitty and Lyle got into a huge argument because Lyle doesn't respect his mother. And it said that she grabbed a hold of his toupee. Now, this is interesting because... these guys are in their late teens, early 20s. He's already wearing a hairpiece because image is that important. And when she grabs a hold of it and rips it off his head, Eric sees this And according to Eric, he didn't even know that his brother wore a hairpiece. He was sick of all the lies and secrets in his family. So he talked to Lyle about the abuse, talked to him about the molestation, although they experienced a lot of this together. And it's even said that because of the abuse, that the brothers actually molested each other in the way that their dad would molest them. So this is not coming out the way that they think it should, but this is when they decided to make a change. This is when they decided that all the secrets have to come out and that they need to remove themselves from this abusive situation, I guess. And they claim that they felt that their parents were going to kill them, that their father was the perpetrator of this, and their mother was at least complicit in all of this. So this is their defense in this first trial. They're fearing for their lives. They feel that they are in danger because of the abuse, the molestation, all of these things, and they needed an out, an escape.
Yeah, let's talk about some of those things that were supposedly occurring. About the abuse between the sons, it was said that Lyle, and he actually testified to this, said that he would sexually abuse his younger brother in the way that he was abused. And I don't really want to go through those details, but just understand that it was supposedly because that's what was happening to him, and he started to pass it on. And this is something that we know happens with people who are abused. Some of them, not all of them, but sometimes those people go on to abuse themselves. Another thing that happened was Lyle had a pet rabbit. Apparently one morning it was found dead in the garbage can. It had had its head bashed in. And, you know, that was seen as maybe his dad had done it. Apparently his parents also would bring his sheets that he had wet the night before down to the breakfast table to humiliate him, you know. And at this point he was 14 and he said he was still wetting his bed. So there's this abuse that encompassed physical, mental, and sexual throughout their lives.
Yeah, there were whippings with belts. It said that their father would push thumbtacks into their behind and their thighs and sodomized him with a toothbrush.
Yeah, there were these code words, supposedly, that Jose Menendez would use. And if he said sex, that was actually sodomy. If he said rough sex, that's when he would use the thumbtacks while he was having his son do things to him. Really, the attorney, whole point of this sexual abuse, bringing all this up, is so that they can appeal to the jury and say, hey, you know, whatever you think, we went through hell. Give it, you know, go easy on us. You have to understand we've been through a lot.
Yeah, these are mitigating factors. Their father is a incestual pedophile, so he deserves to die, or they deserve leniency for their actions, however you want to put it.
Fast forwarding, but at the end of these first trials for both Lyle and Eric, they end up as
hung jury, mistrial.
Mistrials. So in that regard, their attorney, she would say it wasn't a victory in either case, because otherwise her client, the sons, would have been let go. They would have been freed, but they weren't.
Yeah. And if you see the trial and you see their testimony about the abuse, it's pretty convincing. They convinced the jury, at least some of the members of the jury, they convinced the media and a lot of the people in the courtroom, because they were crying along with the brothers as they recited some of these past abuses.
Lyle was breaking down. If it was an act, he was an incredible actor.
It's so good that I'll go out on the record and say, I believe that there was some sort of abuse happening. I believe that they're telling at least a partial truth. There's enough other witness testimony that kind of backs up the behavior of their father that I kind of believe them. I don't know if they're embellishing. I don't know if they're exaggerating. But I truly believe the emotional testimony that they're given.
It's not completely unfounded. Oh, we've covered cases before where someone will just come up with some information, but then there's nothing to back it up. But in this case, we do have some testimony that appears to back up some of what they're saying.
Now, something else we need to mention during this first trial is the prosecutor says that the bailiff witnessed the brothers giving each other a high five after delivering some of this testimony about the abuse. So this is out in the hallway in between sessions. This is very questionable, and it really makes the prosecutor feel like she's doing the right thing. I mean, this is a pretty open and shut case for the prosecution. The state has all the evidence. All they have to do is say, these guys did it. Here's all the evidence. They're confessing to it. Were they in fear of their life? Were they in the middle of being threatened by their father? No, they murdered them. Let's move on. So the whole defense is just mitigating circumstances.
Well, I think that's all they could do. If you look at how the defense ran their case, Leslie Abramson was the attorney. And I think she did a great job of, first of all, making the parents out to be monsters, and then showing you how these sons, you know, maybe they didn't do the right thing here, but they were put in situations that were horrendous. And then by the end of it, you know, where's your heart? I mean, are you going to understand that there are mitigating circumstances here? Or are you just going to come down hard on them because they murdered some people?
And she refers to them routinely as the boys. And during trial, you will see her mothering them, whether it be straightening their sweater, whatever, cardigan, or picking lint off of it, or just holding them. It's a little uncomfortable to watch at times, but hey, we've seen worse in other cases. But it's this whole show of these are immature children that didn't know what they were doing.
Exactly. Like, don't forget, they were being harmed when they were little. So don't forget that they've been in that situation all the way up till not too long before the trial. It's really that picture in the minds of the jury that they know that these were children that were harmed by their parents. And so making them more vulnerable, now you don't quite see them as these cold-blooded killers.
And she did her job. Eric's jury was deadlocked for 18 days. Lyle's, 15 days before they were declared mistrials. We have to go to round two, and this time the judge bans TV cameras and the press from reporting on this, which, wow, I think that this case, if you haven't heard of it, it's probably because you're younger, but it was huge. This was the O.J. Simpson trial before O.J. Simpson. It was a fiasco. So second trial, he doesn't allow cameras in the courtroom. And he doesn't allow most of the abuse testimony. He says that the defense cannot use that. Aaron and I have discussions all the time about cases and some questionable cases. And I always say, man, if you ran this thing through two or three times, you might get a different outcome every time. And this is the perfect example of that. You're running this case through a second time, and all of a sudden, evidence or witness testimony in the first trial that was admissible is no longer admissible. One tiny little thing can change the outcome, and your life depends on it. They can't really use this same defense. All it's based off of now is, were they the murderers? Did they take their parents' life? Yes. Were they using self-defense? Well, they went and bought shotguns prior to the murder, and they ambushed their parents with shotguns. You can't say this is self-defense. They're old enough to move out, right?
Again, though, if you have the defense attorney making the jury see these two as children, I know that's difficult because they're adults, but the way that she's treating them and the way that she's talking about them, it's probably getting in their heads that, you know, they're not adults in a way. I think it is helping. It's the whole idea that they have mitigating factors here. And so in their minds, because of the abuse, they now have it in their heads that they are going to be killed. And so there's that whole question of, if the doors were closed, is that when you felt like that was going to be it? They were going to get you? Which is a weird thing to ask, because they were literally going in to watch a movie and they were having, what, blueberries and ice cream?
Yeah.
So they're going to kill you when? I mean, after they finish their ice cream in the movie? I mean, I just don't really understand this. And I think this is probably one of the moments where the jury was having trouble understanding this whole self-defense angle. It just isn't there.
And then you shot both your mother and father. Your mother, who is not the abuser here. Now, you can say she was complicit. You can say that she knew about it. But the brutal murder of her, it's really hard to justify that, especially when you bring in the additional information that she tried to run and they had to go out to the car, spend a moment getting more shells for their shotgun, go back inside and finish her off. I don't care how you feel about the dad. This scenario with the murder of their mother, you cannot justify that as self-defense at all.
Yeah, Lyle was questioned by the prosecutor about having placed the shotgun muzzle up against her face, against her cheek. Lyle, of course, says, I don't recall that. But they know from the autopsy it was placed up against her cheek before it was fired.
The other thing they're probably going to struggle with is this was premeditated. They planned to do it. They'd purchased these shotguns prior. And then at the time of the murder, they're lying to police saying, well, we just found them this way. And they're trying to confuse and distance themselves from this situation. As far as remorse goes, during trial, Eric's talking about college. And they say, is that important to you, going to college? And he says, yes, college was going to be my escape from my father. That was the only thing that was going to rescue me. Yet, after his father's gone, college isn't really on the menu anymore, and it's buying fancy cars and Rolex watches. So if they actually did follow through with what they said was important to them, maybe the jury could have had more sympathy, but as it was, not so much.
The second trial took place later in 1995. It was March 20th, 1996, when the verdicts came in for Eric and Lyle Menendez.
Now, they had options with their with what they could convict them on. You had first degree, you had second degree, you had manslaughter. I don't want to go off on a tangent here, but this is an interesting little segue of first degree murder has that tag of premeditation. And when you buy the murder weapon before the murder, I think you've just solidified premeditation. But they did offer second degree murder and manslaughter to them, just in case the mitigating factors of these abuse allegations changed anything. But I don't know how you can say, oh, it's second degree when it was premeditated, but they find them guilty on first degree murder charges. So they are convicted, and then they have their sentencing phase, where this is California, they have the death penalty, but they end up getting life in prison. How do you feel about their sentence, Aaron?
Well, first, I should say that anybody who experiences any kind of abuse from their parents, I feel like the abuse is somehow worse, because parents are the ones that you expect to take care of you, to look out for you, to defend you. And in this case, it's clear that there was some type of abuse going on, I think. I just don't know the level of it. I don't know if their dad was just kind of a rough character and was too pushy with them, or if it rose to the level of sexual abuse and physical abuse. So from that angle, I would say no matter what happened, we want to see people not respond with violence. I mean, in this case, two people were brutally murdered. And I think one thing we keep coming back to is at 18 and 21 years of age, they could have moved out.
They could have left.
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/genY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/genY.
They could have left. I understand that there are scenarios and situations where domestic abuse victims can't leave. They're almost held captive. It's just too hard to get out of that situation. How does that apply when it's two brothers who are bigger than their father and possibly capable of leaving? Are they so mentally destroyed by this abuse that they can't? They still were not in fear of their life at that moment. And that's where that changes everything when it comes to their actions.
Well, we didn't really go over this so much, but during the trial, they talked about how there was this fear that something was going on and that there was this sneakiness going on with the parents and shadows and just being on edge. So they tried to paint a scenario in which they were on edge, scared. But remember, they bought the shotguns 2 days before. So from my point of view, this was something that was pre-planned. They were going to kill their parents. And I don't understand how, you know, saying that they were in fear that night, that all of a sudden they have to kill when they had purchased the shotguns using someone else's ID 2 days before. That's all really shady stuff. I don't understand how they can try to mitigate it the way they did.
You can't. It blows the whole defense, self-defense theory out the window. You know, if they had done something earlier, or if they had killed their parents and on that 911 call said, we did this and we had to, I might buy it a little bit more, but it was the whole premeditation. He wrote a script about it. They bought the shotguns and then they tried to cover up the crime.
One of the main things that I see in this case, and this is just my personal opinion here, but I think the reason they really just couldn't leave if there was abuse going on was because there were strings. And by that, I mean, their parents were super wealthy. I mean, at least from where I sit, you know, having a $14.5 million estate, that's a lot of money. And if they had left, what support would they have?
Zero. They would be cut off.
I would think so. You know, that was one of the stories about what was going on at the time was their dad and their mom were so upset with them and their behavior with the burglaries and the other things they were doing that there was talk about changing the will. I had already brought up early on about them hiring a computer expert to delete some files. Again, if you look at this case and forget about what the media was talking about, if you just look at it objectively, all the signs are there of premeditated murder. I would say that greed is a part of it.
Well,
the money is always a part of this case.
There was a huge amount of money. They had wills. The parents had their own separate wills. One of the friends of the mom, Kitty,
she had her will up on her computer and was talking about actively writing her sons out of this will. And her friend's like, you know, they can hear you. Like, they're right down the hall. She goes, I don't care if they can hear me. Meanwhile, their father, who's obviously disappointed in them because they're not coming out to be the winners that he wanted them to be, he's having to back channel them into college because they can't even get there on their own. He's thinking about writing them out of his will also. So what was this file that was deleted off the computer? Sounds like it was Kitty's will that she had augmented or changed and removed them from. So they had to get that out of there so they could get the inheritance.
You and I were well-versed in computers. They couldn't just delete a file on the computer because you can forensically bring that file back. So what you need at that point is either some very good software or someone who knows what they're doing. So they needed some way to delete a file or more files where they couldn't be recovered.
See, and the funny thing is I just figured that they were too stupid to know how to do it themselves, so they had to hire somebody to go find all the documents to delete.
And keep in mind, this is in 1989.
Yeah.
And I don't know when you had your first computer, but we've had computers in our home for quite a number of years, even by that point, different kinds. And so, yeah, computers weren't like they are today where everyone has one. I'm not surprised that they would hire someone with the express purpose of getting rid of certain things. The brothers were sent to prison. They weren't housed near each other. The story was that they would never see each other again.
The brothers obviously are very close. So this was very detrimental to them. This was tearing them apart. I don't know. I mean, this is the system. And would it have mattered if they had been housed at the same prison? I don't know.
It said that they would mail each other letters, and in the letters, they would make their next move on their chessboards. So it was a very slow game of chess. Eric Menendez and Lyle Menendez started writing letters, of course, to people who were writing to them. And Eric married his prison pen pal, a woman by the name of Tammy.
Can I just say that I think it's weird that prisoners aren't allowed to vote, but they are allowed to marry people?
But they can't. These two couldn't consummate their marriages. It's weird. It's like they can be married, but they just get to hold hands. It's an odd situation. And then Lyle had been married twice. He married a model in 1996 named Anna Erickson, and then later married Rebecca Sneed in 2003. But fast forward to 2018, and the brothers are finally together again. They're housed at the same state prison in California. And I guess it's because there was a decision made that there's no real legal reason to keep them apart. They couldn't really keep them apart.
When it comes to their sentence, I think I will buy into their abuse stories. But even with that, the murder of their mother can't be justified in my mind. And their allegations of fearing for their life, and this was self-defense, falls apart under any amount of scrutiny.
One of the questions in this case, because there really aren't too many, is were they actually sexually abused by one or both of their parents? My feeling is, from having done the research, I'm not saying there wasn't abuse in the house. I think there probably was, but sexual abuse is a whole different thing. To me, the pivotal moment is that trial. The first trial is when, you know, they need some way to save themselves. And this is when they bring up the sexual abuse angle. To me, it's sort of like a Hail Mary pass. It had never been brought up before that. Part of the reason is a lot of people have said that there's evidence that the two of them had both read a book. The book they had read was titled When a Child Kills, and it was about abused children who kill their parents. So that basically outlined how someone else had tried to get away with the same thing, you know, saying there was sexual abuse when there wasn't. By reading that book, it's believed that they came up with a way to try and save themselves because going into their trials, what chance did they have when all the evidence was aligned against them and they had all this behavior preceding the murders? I mean, all of it was damning. They looked to be criminals who hated their parents and wanted their money. So what choice do they have but to come up with this sexual abuse angle? Again, not discounting that there was any abuse. I'm saying, at least in my opinion, I think the sexual abuse angle was merely to try and mitigate so that they could get out of this somehow.
I can see that point. I somewhat believe some of the allegations just because in their testimonies, they seem believable. Like I said, seem is the key word here. But when they talk about the self-defense or when they talk about why they had to shoot their parents, they don't seem believable at all to me. It's like they just flub on that part. But then when they talk about the sexual abuse part, they seem more believable. That's why I give them a little bit more credence. I believe the allegations slightly more because they come off better when they talk about that, as opposed to when they talk about the self-defense angle and how they feared for their life. They don't come off well at all to me. So it was almost literally just that in the trial itself that made me believe a little bit, at least some of the allegations could have been real. If you do buy their molestation and abuse allegations, then I guess you could possibly find them guilty of, say, second degree or manslaughter. But again, I can't get over the premeditation. And I guess I'm just too fixated on the definition of first degree murder being premeditated and then the other ones not so much. So I feel that the justice system did what it was supposed to do and their convictions were just. Is life in prison just? I don't know. I think that they committed some brutal murders. So what is the just punishment for that? I think that the possibility of parole should always be on the table, but I don't make the rules.
Well, I don't know if it should always be on the table. I think it depends on the crime. But in this case, I still think money is a big part of it. I think that's why they couldn't really get away. And I would point to their deleting of the files. I would point to their spending sprees. I really think at the heart of this case, no matter what went on in that house, and I'm sure it wasn't very good, that this was about money.
Well, if the bad person in your life is rich, well, you can't say that money's not a factor when you take them out.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
your favorite coffee shop down the street, to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.